This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 15th, 2014. This podcast is presented by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated in cooperation with your State Society of CPAs. Any other use of this audio podcast without the express written consent of your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE Incorporated is prohibited. This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nichols Patrick CPE Incorporated. Let's go ahead and take a look at the developments that have occurred during this week, the week of September 15th, 2014. We're now at the point where we're finishing up all of our entity returns that have been on extension and getting ready for that final push for the 1040s. And while we have a short breathing space here between the two deadlines, let's go ahead and take a look at what may have been going on in the past week while you were trying to take care of all those extended deadlines that were rushing toward you. The first development is a publication from the Office of Professional Responsibility, which is in their online publication labeled Alerts from the Office of Professional Responsibility, issue 2014-12. And it talked about, in this case, an issue about employees of corporations that are under exam by the IRS. And the question became, when those individuals become deemed to be in practice before the IRS and therefore subject to the jurisdiction of the Office of Professional Responsibility. Now, this may surprise some CPAs who work in industry, because you may believe that since you're employed by the company in question, you never could really be in practice like a CPA in public accounting, because you're basically working for and are, in one sense, part of the organization. But it turns out things aren't quite that simple. The particular document talked about was primarily aimed at the LB&I division of the IRS and discusses the LB&I Communications Agreement. Under that program, a corporation can designate certain employees to basically talk with the IRS. And the OPR determines that that agreement operates similar to IRS Form 8821 tax information authorization available outside, you know, to outside individuals. Anybody can have an 8821 signed on their behalf to get information with relation to another taxpayer. However, this does not authorize representation, and it limits what that person can do. The OPR determines that a person operating under that agreement can discuss tax matters with the IRS, provide and receive information, and receive and discuss adjustments or any combination of the above. However, those individuals may not advocate, negotiate, or dispute issues with the IRS. Once an individual starts to do that, then they have to be in practice before the IRS, or, though the article doesn't really say so, it's pretty clear by implication, be what the IRS will refer to here later as an elected corporate officer. If a person is going to represent a corporation in that realm, so if you are going to advocate a position, if you are going to negotiate or dispute issues with the service, and you are not a elected corporate officer, then you must obtain designation on a Form 2848 Power of Attorney form to represent the organization. That 2848 must be signed by an elected corporate officer. The article goes on to say it's not a vanity-titled officer. As you may be aware, in some industries, it's normal to give a whole bunch of people titles of, like, vice president, so there's tons of vice presidents all over the organization, in essence, but none of those are considered true corporate officers being elected by the board of directors. In this case, we're going to have to be an elected corporate officer, must sign that form, designated the employee. Once an employee is designated on the power of attorney to represent the corporation or other entity before the IRS, that person now becomes subject to the jurisdiction of the OPR. And the article goes on to discuss what employees of the LB&I division should do if they begin to discover that a person in such practice is violating Circular 230. Therefore, this document is somewhat useful to remind individuals in industry that even though you may believe all those rules in Circular 230 are irrelevant to you, in fact, if you become involved in a dispute and you become the lead party who is negotiating, advocating, or disputing issues with the service instead of inquiring an outside individual to take care of that, you will probably be asked to file a Form 2848, and once that 2848 is in place for you, you then are considered in practice before the IRS, at least in terms of what the OPR believes. In the case of Miranda versus Commissioner, we're going to talk about some interesting questions about a distinguishment between a case that occurred a number of years ago, the Hammond case, which was a Sixth Circuit case in 2008, and what happened to the gentleman in Miranda. In both cases, the taxpayers entered into a plea agreement where they pled guilty to essentially evading taxes. Now, Mr. Miranda's case pretty much says that he evaded a specific amount of tax involved. Now we're done. He's been sentenced. His criminal, sentence is in place. Now the problem is the IRS goes, obviously, to collect the money, and this is now a civil matter, the civil case of collecting the funds, and Mr. Miranda tries to file a civil action claiming that the IRS amount of tax is an error and that actually he doesn't owe what they claim he owes. He based this on the fact, I may think it's weird because he did sign a plea agreement, he said, yeah, but in the case of United States versus Hammond, Sixth Circuit, you allowed a taxpayer who entered a plea agreement to dispute the amount of tax due. And the Sixth Circuit said, Mr. Miranda, you're right in that case, but there's a difference. In the case of United States versus Hammond, the plea agreement said he had pled guilty to evading taxes of approximately, and that was a key word, $2.39 million. The court found that in that case, the terms of the plea agreement did not fix the amount of tax in question because the plea agreement simply said approximately but didn't deal with exact amounts. So Mr. Hammond could go forward with disputing the amount of tax due in a civil matter. Unlike the Hammond case, Ms. Miranda's case gave an exact to the penny amount of tax due in his plea agreement, and he agreed that he owed that amount of tax. The court said because of the specificity, that was a key condition of the plea agreement. And Mr. Miranda had received a benefit from that plea agreement because, as he admitted, he entered the plea agreement so that it would avoid any chance of other related parties, his wife or children, being drawn into and having to spend time in prison. Because of that, the court found that he was therefore locked. He had previously basically tied down the amount of tax due and was judicially estopped from being able to dispute that amount again. What this really tells us is the Department of Justice and the IRS learned their lesson from the Hammond case. And now the IRS and Department of Justice knows if you get somebody to plead guilty to criminal tax evasion, you're going to put down an exact amount of tax due, in essence, work out what they owe exactly, and get them to agree to that in writing. If they do, the Sixth Circuit said, then they are not allowed to dispute the amount of tax in question. The next case is Cosentino versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-186. This particular case deals with a question of the taxability of damage payments received from a tax advisor. This is important because quite often in litigation, this is important not only from a tax standpoint, but for all of us from the standpoint about what happens if something goes wrong in an engagement. The question becomes, if you pay a taxpayer for damages and part of those damages relates to the tax that was owed by the taxpayer based on whatever advice you gave, is that payment of taxes, is that reimbursement of taxes a taxable event? The problem, of course, is if it is and the taxpayer is going to pay tax on that amount and they're still working to get back, quote, the amount of tax they paid, then the problem is going to be that you're going to have to pay even more in damages because you'll not only have to pay those taxes, but effectively the tax on those taxes is part of your damages. In this case, Mr. Cosentino entered into a basis inflation tax shelter, one of those wonderful variants that were being pushed all through the early part of the 2000s. Shortly after he had entered into it and filed the return, the IRS published documents that indicated they considered the shelter to be abusive. Mr. Cosentino was not aware of that when he entered into the transaction, that this was a shelter that kind of pushed the limits, and he therefore files an immediate amended return, pays the tax due, and then goes back to the advisor claiming damages from the advisor for entering him into a shelter that was far more aggressive than he believed was appropriate, that in essence it was not the slam dunk he had been told. Eventually, the advisor and Mr. Cosentino enter into a settlement where he's paid for various things, and part of the damage claim involved a payment of the taxes that were due. Now, based on the IRS's position, the IRS's position was, well, you know, those are taxes that you should have paid and didn't. If you're reimbursed for those, that should be considered taxable income. They do note that if, in fact, you'd paid taxes that never would have been paid, they agree that based on a case, Clark versus Commissioner, which goes back to the old Board of Tax Appeals, it's a 1939 case, 40 BTA 333, that if you're paying taxes that never should have been paid, then that's not considered a taxable item. In the case of Clark, what happened was an advisor had told Mr. and Mrs. Clark that it would be advantageous for them to file a joint return. It turned out that in reality, it would have been better for them to file a separate return, but they didn't discover that until after the return had been filed. As we're all aware, the election to file a joint return is not one at the federal level you're going to get out of by trying to amend back later, so the advisor paid them the extra tax they had paid due to filing a joint return. In the Clark case, the court held because they were merely being made whole for a tax that never should have been paid and would not have been paid had they received proper advice, because they certainly would have filed the separate returns, that was not taxable. It was merely making the taxpayer whole. The IRS claimed this, of course, case wasn't the same thing. However, the taxpayer had a history. The taxpayer was sheltering a gain from sale of real estate. Previously, the taxpayer had always entered into 1031 exchanges with regard to real estate. What the court ended up concluding here was that the taxpayer A would have entered into a new 1031 exchange had they not entered into this basis shifting, because they had done 1031 exchanges in the past. Secondly, the court found that the taxpayer would not have, you know, actually would never have paid the tax, because there was clear documentation for years that the taxpayer's ultimate plan previously had been to always 1031 exchange real estate until it passed through an estate, at which point they'll get a step up in basis. While this is a good case, interesting note, the IRS is likely to challenge any damage awards that you attempt to keep out of taxes where somebody got a damage award from a tax advisor. Last year, we had the case of Chief Counsel Advice 2013-07-005 that dealt with a very similar situation of a basis, of not the basis inflation, but this was a abusive ESOP program where the taxpayer claimed they would have done something different, and the IRS claimed that was taxable. That is probably distinguishable, even the court would probably see it as distinguishable, because in that case, at least believing what we see in the CCA, there was no evidence that the taxpayer had any other particular transaction in mind, or that there was any evidence they would have undertaken any other transaction. They were just asserting they could have. Could have probably is not good enough. But expect to see challenges on this. However, understand that if you can build analysis based on the Clark decision, you probably have a very solid position for excluding the damage awards. But to do that, it will be very helpful to find some particular action, not only that the taxpayer could have taken, but that there's some evidence they would have taken had they not been given and entered into this shelter that fell apart. In the case of Vanny Associates, Inc. versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-184, we have a botched attempt to make a year-end bonus payment. This is what appears to be a personal service corporation, C Corporation. The individual in question is the architect owner. The end of the year came up, and he had taken salaries of over $200,000, but it turns out the company had a whole lot of income left over, something that's not unusual for a personal service corporation, especially when the person in question is the only service provider. He needed to take a check of $840,000 to basically pay out the income of the corporation. Now, this particular case is not an excessive compensation case because for various reasons that would cause the IRS problems in the S Corporation realm, it's not very likely they're going to challenge excessive comp for a service corporation with one service provider. The argument in the S Corp cases has always been that that person generated all the income, therefore all income truly should represent salary to them if paid out. So the IRS isn't disputing that, but here's the problem. When the end of the year came around, there were not sufficient funds in the bank account to pay the check. Turns out at the end of the day, his check, after netting for the taxes that were withheld and paid on his behalf, he got a check for $464,000. Turns out that at that time in question, the actual balance available in the bank account was $285,000, And even if we ignored the checks that were, you know, still in the float, you know, that wouldn't be cashed till after the beginning of the year because they were still outstanding at the end of December, there was still only $390,000. So by definition, this check would not have been accepted by the bank had he gone down and tried to cash it. But what he did was, and he was aware there's not sufficient funds, what he did was he endorsed the check back to the company. And while the opinion doesn't make it clear, it appears that what he really did was endorsed it back, then simply put it away in a desk drawer. Didn't worry about going down, cashing it at the bank, or any of those things, because it's a check from the company to itself. That's kind of an absurdity. So therefore, ignore it. The tax court found in that case that there was actually no payment made in the year in question. Rather, because there were insufficient funds to pay the check, the tax court notes that the tax court has more than once denied deductions to cash basis taxpayers who write checks where there's insufficient funds. Secondly, the courts also found cases where a taxpayer received a check from a company but was aware that the check did not have sufficient funds to cover it and held it till the next year, and they've held those checks even when held by independent third parties, do not constitute deductible payments. The court found in this case that the taxpayer knew there was no such check outstanding. There was no funds outstanding to cash this check, never attempted to cash it. The taxpayer argued they could have got a loan. Tax court said could have is not good enough. You should have gone out and got the loan. Now, this is a practical problem faced by a lot of closely held corporations at the end of a year where there's insufficient funds to pay a bonus equal to the amount that may wish to be paid or maybe even under the terms of a formal bonus agreement is supposed to be paid. And because it's going to the more than 50% owner in a C corporation, we need to have it paid before a year and not just simply accrued. Well, the catch becomes what could they have done differently that could have changed the facts? It appears pretty clear that one thing that may very well have changed the facts would have been if the architect had actually loaned money to the corporation himself. Now, there clearly is a question if you loan that money to the corporation on December 31st and you don't really have enough funds in your bank account to cover the loan so that you're trading checks where neither check could be honored without the other one being executed at the same time by the bank, that may or may not be deemed to be a real transaction for the courts. That's a little iffy. What probably is safer is to have the owner go ahead and make a deposit out of funds they have available sometime prior to the last day of the year and then take the bonus out of those advance funds. Or perhaps go ahead and get the third-party loan as mentioned here that is paid off at the beginning of the year. Yes, there's a cost to that, but it would allow you to ensure that the bonus will be respected. The problem in this case is simply writing a check and then endorsing it back to the company and putting it away has been held by the tax court to not represent the payment of the bonus. And in this case, Vanni Associates ends up with no bonus paid at year-end and at $840,000 would apparently have just become taxable income to the corporation in the year. Assuming it's a personal service corporation, that's going to be a very expensive amount of tax due for that year. Couple of others here as we close out. Private Letter Ruling 2014-37004 is interesting because it allowed a deduction for payments to a 501c3 organization as a business expense. That was very interesting because it was allowed based on the fact that there was an operating agreement with the state. The state required you had to get a certificate to operate in this industry. If there was a shortfall, they paid the excess or the amount of shortfall. It was a percent of gross revenue. They had to meet a condition of paying a percent of gross revenue, using it for certain purposes. If there's a shortfall, they paid the excess to a 501c3. The court found that was a business expense. It was not a gratuitous transfer, but related to a business. Therefore, it was considered to be a business deduction. Private Letter Ruling 2014-37023, if you run into this problem with a custodian that says, wait, the taxpayer mailed their IRA contribution on April the 15th, but it wasn't deposited and it wasn't received by the custodian until after, Private Ruling 2014-37023 makes clear that the date of the postmark on the letter is what counts for this purpose. It even makes clear that if the taxpayer calls the custodian and says, transfer funds from this other account you're holding for me into the IRA, that will count if the call is made on or before April 15th, even if the actual transfer takes place after that date. Finally, TAM 2014-37012 is interesting if you're involved in any like-kind exchange programs on equipment. In this case, those are complex equipments where you have constantly changing equipment. So you put equipment back into the pool and get new equipment. And by being involved in this program, we're constantly using an intermediary. It allows us not to pick up that depreciation recapture because we roll into the next piece of equipment we're picking up. Taxpayer was involved in such a like-kind exchange program on equipment, LKE. The problem they ran into was that one of the sales, the equipment that they showed on the like-kind exchange form filed with the return, was determined by the service under examination not to be like-kind equipment. However, they did acquire other equipment that had been identified as possible replacement property for this property within the time frame, and that was like-kind equipment. The national office, disagreeing with the agents on the ground, said, you can count that. That works. And therefore, now this gives us a rolling problem because that property had been used as exchange equipment for property that had been received, you know, basically in a separate exchange. But basically you just keep rolling it forward. As long as you can find adequate replacement property to take over for the property you're pulling out to cover a previous sale, there is no failed like-kind exchange until we find one we can't make it work. So an interesting case where the IRS ruled against their agents, TAM 2014-37012. This has been the Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 15th, 2014. Be sure to check back in next week as we go over more recent developments in the areas of federal taxes.